Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Podcast on the Brink, your weekly dose of Indiana basketball news and discussion, brought to you by the Assembly Call and Inside the Hall. I'm your host, Jared Morris. Join me live at assemblycall.com every Thursday night and immediately following every IU game for our live IU postgame show. And visit InsideTheHall.com for complete coverage of IU basketball and to join the discussion in the Inside the Hall Premium Forum.
We are back for our second episode of Podcast on the Brink this week. And joining me as a special guest host from Bloomington, Cam Drummond, and also we have a guest this week as well, Ben Ladner, who covered IU basketball last season for Inside the Hall, my favorite NBA expert, and he also covered the Atlanta Hawks this past season for Sports Illustrated and the Maven. Welcome Cam, and welcome Ben to this week's second edition of Podcast on the Brink.
Thanks for having us. It's good to be here.
Yep, always great to chat with two of my favorite IU basketball-related experts, and I guess we'll be focused a bit more on the NBA this time, but still with a bit of an Indiana flavor to it, looking at some of the Hoosiers in the professional ranks right now.
Absolutely. Ben, I wanted to start off with asking you just a big-picture question about the restart that's coming for the NBA and the whole bubble that's being, is still kind of being tweaked and figured out in Orlando. What are your thoughts on this setup and how it's going to work? Is it going to be a success? Do you have any concerns about how it will work?
I do have some concerns as for whether it'll be a success. I think that's the question we're all hoping that the answer will be yes to. I mean, I sure hope that everything goes, you know, off without a hitch and kind of goes smoothly. I'm not sure that's guaranteed, which is kind of where some of the concern sets in. You know, anytime you return to play, there's going to be some level of risk. So the NBA was always going to risk, you know, spreading, contracting the virus, you know, throughout the league, no matter what format they decided to return to. It was just how much risk are they comfortable with. And the answer evidently was 22 teams worth of risk. It's a number that I probably wouldn't have gone that high. I don't really see why we need the Wizards or Suns in there, to be honest. And frankly, I would have been okay with just keeping the 16 teams that were already in the playoffs and saying, these are the playoffs, this is what we're doing. It's a shortened season, but it's also an unprecedented time. So it's not going to be fair. And some team would have gotten screwed over by that in some way. But, you know, it's hard to see this kind of crisis coming. And so I think that calls for you know, somewhat unprecedented leadership in unprecedented times and unprecedented solutions. And, you know, this certainly is that, but it's not necessarily the way I would have gone, because not only are you putting more people at risk by including more teams, I also, you know, they didn't really execute any of the creative ideas that we were hearing about, you know, leading up to the return to play. They're not doing the group stage. They're not really doing a play-in tournament. There's sort of a possibility for that, but it's not the true like round robin style, you know, March Madness style of thing that they were floating. It's kind of just a compromise between a lot of really strange and sometimes not great options. So to me, I would have either just, you know, kept the 16 teams that were already in the playoffs and gone ahead and started with the training camp ahead of time, or I would have gotten a little more creative with probably 20 teams as opposed to 22. Because again, I think the biggest concern here has to be safety. And clearly it wasn't, because if it were, there wouldn't be 22 teams. And I just don't see any reason for having those two teams I mentioned, Phoenix and Washington, in this bubble. You know, to me, it's just an added layer of risk that was unnecessary. And again, I hope that it all goes smoothly. I hope that no one gets sick. But I think the more teams you add, the greater risk you run of you know, a greater crisis and exacerbating already a bad situation. And so to me, the NBA kind of, you know, they prioritize the wrong things to some extent. And you can understand why, but it's also a decision that's going to get, I think, rightly criticized by a lot of people.
I think one of the things that's been interesting to me to follow just from afar, I mean, obviously I watch the NBA, but I'm not plugged in, you know, on the day-to-day basis. But from a reporting standpoint and kind of this whole setup, and I mentioned this to Cam before you joined the call, but, you know, yesterday we saw some things reported. I think Woj had some notes that certain players were now having second thoughts about kind of going into the bubble and how it would all work. If, I mean, do you think there's a real possibility that there's going to be players who don't want to do this and are going to sit out? And do you think the NBA has any leeway to kind of back off that, you know, the restrictions? Because I think from a public health standpoint, the whole reason that they decided to do this in Orlando and kind of under this whole bubble was to kind of keep everybody isolated. And then if they kind of go back on that, then everyone's probably going to say, well, why didn't you just play in your home cities? And what was the reason to even do this in the first place?
Yeah, it's definitely safer, I think, to play in one centralized location than to fly everyone around. You know, the bubble, the idea of a bubble, I think, is sound. It's just a question of, can you preserve the integrity of the bubble? That's what we're going to have to see. You know, it's as far as players opting out and not wanting to play, I totally understand that. You know, this is a contact sport. People are sweating on each other. They're breathing on each other. They're making contact. Like, it is a very like intimate close quarters sport. It's not like you can, it's not like golf. It's not like baseball where you can kind of avoid contact with people if you really want to. You can't social distance on a basketball court. You know, even the Houston Rockets, who have the best spacing in the NBA, are going to have a hard time standing 6 feet apart from everyone at all times. So I can understand players not wanting to do this, but at the same time, the players who, if there are any, who elect not to play are not going to be paid for those games. They're not going to be able to compete for a championship, which a lot of these players are going to have the chance to do. So, I mean, really, technically they have the option, but there's very little incentive to actually take that option. And all the incentive basically is to play and to kind of go along with the NBA's plan. And I think a lot of the players trust Adam Silver, and they sort of, not blindly necessarily, but they do have this idea that, okay, well, even if I feel a little nervous about it, if Adam Silver is okay with it, if he thinks this is a viable option, then whatever my misgivings, I'm ultimately going to be okay with it because I trust his judgment and his leadership. But that's going to be put to the test. And, you know, if someone contracts the virus, especially if multiple people contract the virus, especially on the same team, I think you're going to hear some voices within the league saying, yeah, this was a bad idea. This was always a bad idea. This is why people didn't want to do it. And this is the worst case scenario that we all wanted to avoid. So there is a lot riding on the people who made this decision to be correct, because the stakes are pretty high. And if, you know, in all likelihood, if things go wrong, it's not going to be the people who made the decision to go forward with this plan who pay the price. It's going to be the players, the coaches, the people who are sort of coerced is not necessarily the right word, but sort of, you know, made to follow this plan, even if they don't feel entirely comfortable doing so. You know, Adam Silver, I don't even know if he's going to be in the bubble. He is not likely to contract the coronavirus in the same way that LeBron James is, for instance. You know, so I could see a little bit of reservation from the side of the players saying, well, hang on, we're the ones who have to go forward with this. We're not the ones, we're not on the board of governors. We didn't get a vote in this. Especially role players who don't really have the pull that a lot of those stars do to say, here's what we want to do. Here's what the players are feeling. You know, if you're, I don't know, Jared Dudley, you can't necessarily go to Adam Silver and say, hey, here's what we should do. He doesn't have that kind of pull. Most guys don't have that kind of pull. And yet they're going to be at just the same risk to contract the virus as anyone. So I can totally understand a little bit of reservation and hesitation from some players from that standpoint.
Yeah, Ben, kind of going off that, you talked about maybe the trust that players have to have in the owners and Adam Silver in particular. And we're seeing kind of an interesting dynamic between what's happening in the NBA and in other sports around the world versus something like baseball in the United States, where obviously there's a big impasse between owners and players about how they should play. We've seen European Soccer League start back up. We've seen obviously the NBA and the NHL have pretty concrete plans in terms of how they're going to get back to on-sport, you know, participation in broadcasting games, playing of the games. Do you think that the NBA's decision to come back will affect it in any way in terms of maybe popularity around the country, or just, you know, any kind of straight viewership takeaways, or just maybe the image of the sport and how it can be helped by the fact that it's actually got a concrete plan to come back to play during COVID-19?
Well, I think you could see maybe an inverse correlation between ratings and like PR sentiment, if that makes sense. Like, I think you'll see a lot, like really good ratings when the NBA comes back. People are starving for sports. They want to watch live sports, you know, particularly in America, you know, with an American sports league playing the games that they're familiar with. So I think the ratings will indicate that it's really popular and that people really want this. I also think you'll see a lot of people criticizing the NBA in similar to the way I have so far on this podcast, saying like, this isn't safe. They could have handled this a little bit better, all of which is true. So I think both of those things can be true at the same time. I think the league can benefit from being kind of the first league back in a lot of ways, and you know, take advantage of that hunger that a lot of fans have for live sports, while also maybe taking a PR hit as far as like, maybe this isn't, you know, the progressive league that everyone thought this was in terms of, you know, being on the side of data and empirical evidence and paying attention to that kind of stuff. Like the NBA is acting a little recklessly here. And I think their reputation could maybe be hurt a little bit by that. Not in a crippling way, not like they're going to fall off the face of the earth or have people boycott the league or anything, but you could see a little bit of even hardcore NBA fans saying, as much as I like seeing the product back on the floor, as much as I love seeing these guys play basketball again, I do have, you know, questions about how safe this is and whether this was really the right thing to do. Is it worth the entertainment factor of having live sports back in our lives if it means that you're potentially putting hundreds, even thousands of people at risk of contracting a deadly virus? You know, because it's not just going to be the players. If a player contracts the virus and then their team gets eliminated from the playoffs and then they fly back home and they give it to someone else, well, now you've started spreading it through whatever circle, you know, that player hangs with, and it gets wider and wider. That's how this thing spreads. So there's always going to be that risk. Like I said, you have to live with some degree of risk if you want to bring sports back. But to me, it was you didn't have to take it this far. You didn't have to expand it this much. I think they could have been a little bit more conservative on this issue, and it would have been probably the better way to go.
Yeah, so I guess kind of on that note, let's look at the expansion now. You mentioned earlier 22 of the league's 30 teams are going to be participating in this kind of regular season, postseason hybrid bubble thing in Orlando. And that means that from an Indiana basketball perspective, there's going to be 8 of the 9 Hoosiers currently in the NBA involved. Looks like Cody Zeller from Charlotte's going to be the lone guy to miss out. But, you know, when you look at some of the names that are going to be participating in this, should everything go correctly, you got Eric Gordon on Houston, Victor Oladipo with the Pacers, you know, even a guy like OG coming back, you know, trying to help Toronto defend their NBA championship. Is there a name or two that kind of jumps out to you as someone who could be part of a team making a deep playoff run, or, you know, even reaching the finals and maybe bringing back some hardware as well?
Well, you mentioned him, OG Anunoby. I think he could be the most critical Hoosier, unless I'm missing some name on this list. I don't really see Romeo Langford playing a key role. The Pacers, to me, you know, are not good enough for Victor Oladipo to really be a huge factor here, especially because he's coming back from an injury and we just haven't seen that team at full strength for most of the year. But OG is, I mean, I thought he was deserving of an all defensive recognition this season. I thought he was really good on that side of the ball. He's one of the most versatile defenders in the NBA. He's arguably the best isolation defender. Just like if you're playing the Lakers and you need a stop on one possession, or you're playing the Rockets or the Clippers and you need someone to guard LeBron or James Harden or Kawhi Leonard, there might not be a better defender in the entire league than OG Anunoby. So for that reason, I think he could be a key part of what is a really, really good Toronto team. Now, are they good enough to win the title? I don't think so, mostly because they play in the same conference as the Bucks, and I think the Bucks should be the prohibitive favorites to win. And secondly, I think Toronto is maybe a little bit more of a regular season team this season. than a playoff team, and certainly more of a lower playoff ceiling to me than they had last year when they won the title and were a little bit more of the inverse, kind of a good regular season team with a high postseason floor. I think they're kind of the opposite this year. They were my favorite team to watch in the NBA this year, and OG was a big reason for that. But I don't really see them having that same upside as a team like the Bucks or even the Celtics in the Eastern Conference. That said, I could see them making a conference finals and taking the Bucks to six and making a series out of it. But I don't know that there's – I mean, you look at the three best teams in the league, the Clippers, the Lakers, and the Bucks. Unless I'm missing someone, there are no Indiana alumni on any of those teams. So as far as swinging the title picture, I don't think there's anyone out there. But if you're just looking for someone to play a really key role and swing a series or, you know, help make a team more competitive than they'd otherwise be, I think OG could be a really, really important player in that sense.
And you brought up an interesting point there, though. You talking about the teams that, you know, were the best in the NBA this season, the Bucks, the Lakers, the Clippers. Now that, and this is stepping, I guess, away a little bit from the IU guys for a second, but just in terms of the big picture of this whole setup, do you think that having no home court advantage in this new setup opens it up for other teams, maybe like a Toronto or Boston, to topple the Bucks? And in the Western Conference, teams maybe have a chance to topple the Lakers and the Clippers just based on the unpredictability of the atmosphere that these games are going to be played in.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I don't know. You know, I think the crowd, like the crowd factor of home court advantage, maybe is not. I don't really see that as like a thing that could swing a series, unless it's just a really close. You know, it's going to come down to a game seven, and whoever has home court wins it. Although we've certainly seen teams win game sevens on the road before. I think it's more in terms of just, you know, having the higher seed and the easier path to the playoffs. That's kind of the better incentive of having a higher seed. I think the real result of no home court advantage is actually going to affect both teams, which is that there just won't be any fans in the crowd, and the energy in the arena is just going to be significantly lower. You know, I keep wondering what's going to happen if, like, LeBron goes in for some huge dunk over, I don't know, say Rudy Gobert, you know, and instead of the crowd cheering and him like flexing and yelling at the crowd, like, what is that going to sound like if there's no one, you know, to yell along with him? I'm really curious to see what that looks like. Will it be more like a pickup game? Will it be more like the All-Star game? I have no idea. I'm excited to find out. I think it'll be really interesting. But just as far as, you know, is this going to get in the head of the home team, the ostensible home team? Not necessarily, and especially because I think the Bucks are just so much better than the rest of the Eastern Conference. I don't know that it'll play a huge role in the East. The West is a little more interesting because I keep thinking about the potential Clippers-Lakers Western Conference Finals, and I think this could actually really help the Clippers in that sense. They're maybe the one team that could really meaningfully stand to benefit from this, because if they had met in the Conference Finals, like, all seven of those games are effectively going to be Laker home games, I think, because that's just kind of the way that city leans. And so you take away that crowd, you take away whatever marginal swing a home court crowd could have for the Lakers, I think the Clippers could actually benefit from that. But other than them, I don't really see a team that is good enough or has a profound enough home court advantage with fans in attendance to really make a meaningful difference in the championship race.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
I think it's fair to say that we didn't see the real Victor Oladipo this season after he came back, and that was kind of expected based on the severity of the injury and the long layoff. But what do you see as kind of his ceiling when the season does resume? Do you think this extra time could have helped him in any way? And what do you kind of see? I mean, obviously I have a lot of people that listen to the podcast that follow the Pacers. What do you see as their ceiling as a playoff team?
That's a hard question to answer because we saw so little of Oladipo before he came back. You know, it's hard for me I really don't have a great feel on what he's going to look like when he comes back. I would presume to guess that he's going to look better because this is effectively just more rehab time for him coming back from an injury like that. So I would think that he has more trust in that knee and just that side of his body in general. And it's stronger. He feels a little better pushing off of it. I would imagine this would give him a chance to kind of work on the motor skills that may have diminished in his absence. Cause you lose some of that when you can't really, you know, move and get the cardio in, work against NBA competition. So just as far as the ball handling, the burst going toward the rim, getting downhill, that was his main thing in that year that he was in all NBA selection was he could come around the pick and roll, give you that in and out dribble and just get to the basket. He was so fast, so quick with the ball in his hands. So if he can return to that level, that gives them a really important dynamic piece in their backcourt because they lacked a little bit of that before the hiatus and especially before Oladipo came back. I think in theory, he and Malcolm Brogdon are like a perfect complement. They're both sort of combo guards who can play the nominal point guard or shooting guard positions. And you can kind of interchange them based on how you want the defensive matchups to look, who you want to handle the ball, whatever matchups you want to pick at on the offensive end. They're really interchangeable and you can kind of switch their roles around pretty seamlessly because they can both shoot, they can both handle, they can just do a lot of things that make them easy fits. And so if that all starts to click together, if they can kind of find whatever that theoretical version of the Pacers was when they first made that sign and trade for Brogdon, if that version of the Pacers really materializes, I could see them pushing a team like the Heat in the first round and maybe stealing a first round series. I still just think that they lack kind of the top end talent. As much as I like Domantas Sabonis' game, I think he's a really, really good, like fun, high post kind of fulcrum of their offense. Oladipo, when he's got it going, like his zip and his downhill burst is really fun to watch. Brogdon has been a favorite of mine for a long time. But I don't know that any of those guys are like clear all-star level talents at this point in their career. And you match that up against a team with Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo, a team with Pascal Siakam and Kyle Lowry, a team with Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown and Kemba Walker. You just look at kind of the top end ceiling of a lot of those teams, and I don't think the Pacers are quite on the same level as them.
Obviously, you're kind of one of the more intellectual basketball minds to ever come through the Indiana beat, and I know just whether it's in your writing with SI or even in the podcast you do Read and React with John Sauber, you love to kind of talk about the big picture ideals of basketball, and a way that Indiana kind of works into the NBA discussion of that is Eric Gordon with the Houston Rockets. I mean, obviously, they were trying this radical small ball experiment that, you know, kind of got cut short during the NBA stoppage due to COVID, but it's going to get set to ramp up again. And for Gordon himself, he, you know, had a pretty down year compared to his prior NBA seasons after he dealt with some knee surgery back at the end of 2019. So I'm just kind of curious to pick your brain on, do you think the whole small ball experiment will be altered? Will its results in a way be nullified because of the stoppage that the season had in any way that, you know, Eric Gordon kind of fits into that picture as Houston looks to resume this very strange, unique approach to trying to win a title?
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the big mysteries that went unsolved with the suspension of the season. We never really got to see how that experiment, if you want to call it that, with the Rockets would have played out. You know, I liked the direction they were heading, if for no other reason than I think they were a fringe championship contender to begin with, even with Clint Capella. And for a team like them, it's really championship or bust. If they don't win the title, it's a failed season. And so if you can increase your variability, And even if you lower your floor a little bit, if you can raise your ceiling by making a move like that, given where their title odds were to begin with, I think you make that move. I think you make kind of the high risk, low reward type of move because the payoff of that risk is much more valuable than the risk is negative, right? I mean, downside is don't win a championship, and that was already the downside. And so there's really, it's kind of a binary thing for a team like the Rockets. You either win the title or you don't. And so if you can increase the odds of the former thing happening, you know, I think you take that gamble, so to speak, 9-10 times out of 10. As far as Gordon's place in the whole thing, I think the biggest area they're going to need him is on defense because the backcourt of James Harden and Russell Westbrook is not a good defensive backcourt. I don't think that's any secret. And in fact, you know, I think Harden gets a lot of crap for his defense, but Westbrook might be worse at this point in his career. It's pretty close. Either way, it's not a good pairing there. And it's almost cheating to even call Harden like a backcourt player on defense, because he mostly guards power forwards and centers. But however you want to assign positions, Gordon is the guy that has to guard, you know, the high-powered wings, especially if they play a team like the Clippers. You know, P.J. Tucker can guard, you know, can do his best on Kawhi Leonard, and then someone's got to guard Paul George. And it's not going to be Westbrook, and it's not going to be Harden. So a lot is on Gordon's shoulders defensively, probably more than he can handle, to be honest. I think he's a solid defender, you know, if he's like your fourth or fifth best defender, which he was a couple years ago when the Rockets got to the Western Conference Finals. But I don't think he has quite the length or the foot speed to really be like a real wing stopper. And Covington can do that a little bit. He's probably a guy I should have mentioned, but he's not amazing sliding his feet either. I don't think he has the quickness to really stay in front of like an elite, you know, really, really high powered wing. A lot of the time he's more of a kind of a help defender, you know, being at the nail, mucking up passing lanes, rotating over to protect the rim, things like that. So that's all really important. And I think the Rockets defense it can be good just as a team, but in those moments where the other team is slowing the game down and just giving the ball to their best player to get a bucket, those team defensive attributes don't really shine through as much. They're not quite as valuable because there's not so much a help defender can do if Kawhi Leonard is rising up from the mid-range, right? So if you don't have the guy that can bother those shots and slide his feet and get a good contest on those shots, you're kind of dead in the water in a lot of ways. So I wonder how often Gordon's going to have to be that guy. And then if he is, how effective can he be in that role? I think that's one of the Rockets' big questions coming into this thing.
And one of the last guys I kind of wanted to specifically get your thoughts on would be Thomas Bryant over at Washington, if for no other reason than you were probably subjected to more Wizards games than the average person just from watching them play the Hawks so much this year as they battled for 14th or whatever in the Eastern Conference.
But I felt like I watched the Wizards play the Hawks 6 times this year. It really, really felt that way.
So I guess you clearly saw a bit of Bryant's growth this year. He's a guy who I think he's got 2 years remaining on that deal. I mean, it'll take Washington a lot longer than that to probably be anywhere near Eastern Conference Finals contenders there on the East Coast. But he averaged 12-7 this year. Obviously, has kind of continued to grow, especially on the defensive end, as you know, a way to kind of anchor the rim protection for Washington. Just kind of curious, especially because he bled over with your time, I think, covering Indiana basketball maybe for a season, what your thoughts of his growth and maturity in the NBA has been, and maybe what's next for him if he doesn't want to, you know, for lack of a better term, kind of get marooned off the playoff island like Cody Zeller kind of has been in Charlotte for his entire career.
Yeah, I think most of his growth has come on offense, where he's turned into a pretty good, you know, floor spacing five, kind of a 3-point shooting spot up, and can also roll to the basket and finish pretty efficiently there. He's got good length and pretty decent touch around the rim. And even dating back to Indiana, he was a pretty good 3-point shooter. And who could really help your offense's spacing, and then obviously just the benefit of getting 3 points on those shots at a high percentage. Defensively, to me, he's still one of the worst centers in the NBA. Just has very little mobility, very slow reactions, and relatively poor instincts for a defensive anchor in the NBA. And in the playoffs, those problems really come to bear. I'm not sure it'll matter for the Wizards, frankly, because I don't see them getting into the playoffs. But if they do, like, I see Giannis like driving around Thomas Bryant 50 times a game in the first round. You know, it's just, it's going to be a tough situation for the Wizards. I would imagine they'd probably turn to Jan Mahinmi at that point, who's really not that much better, but it's kind of the best the Wizards have. It's another reason why they just shouldn't have been included in this thing in the first place. When you look at kind of their depth at center, especially on defense. But with Bryant, you know, I think he'll be a solid offensive big man for most of his career. Maybe he sharpens up his instincts. He's a hard worker. You talk to anyone in the league and that guy puts the work in. He's in the gym. He watches film, things like that. There are certain problems, though, that are hard to correct, and foot speed is one of them. He's got good length, so if he can translate that and combine it with sharper reaction time and just improving his instincts, maybe he could be kind of a good stationary rim protector, where he's just kind of patrolling the lane and making reads and coming over to protect the rim. But I don't think he's ever going to be a guy who's like rotating across the floor like PJ Tucker and, you know, making these amazing rotations and walling off drives, things like that. I don't think he's ever going to be a particularly disruptive help defender. And obviously, not going to be a switch guy on the perimeter, switching onto guards. So it's really, he's a guy that you have to build a strong defense around. And it's actually a good example of why, you know, guys like Thomas Bryant are not especially valuable in today's NBA, because center is such an important defensive position that you need, if you don't have a strong defensive center, you need a strong defensive power forward, you need a strong defensive small forward, and other good personnel around him. And that center needs to be good enough on offense to justify building the defense around him. And Bryant is just, he's not Karl Anthony Towns. You know, he's not good enough on offense to really say, okay, it's worth building like a quality defense around his limitations on that end of the floor. So what ends up happening is his defense is too costly for us to have him on the floor, and the offense is not good enough for us to justify the defense. So that's kind of where I see his role being in the playoffs, where it's just, he's a hard guy, I think, to have on the floor in the highest leverage situations.
And I look at the Boston Celtics roster and what they have with Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown and Gordon Hayward, and I wonder kind of where Romeo Langford can fit there for the long term. What do you think his fit is long term in Boston? Is there one, and do you see him as somebody that can carve out a role there, maybe as a second unit bench scorer, or do you think it's going to have to come somewhere else for him if he's really going to make his mark in the league?
Well, this season, it's definitely going to have to be on the defensive end, and that's kind of where he's gotten his minutes mostly, as kind of an energy guy off the bench, which is kind of funny given his the way he played in college. He was very much the opposite, you know, primary ball handler, primary scorer, very few scoring options around him, and now it's he's asked to be basically do the exact opposite, and he's done a decent job, I think. You know, he's not an amazing shooter yet. I think it's going to take some time for him to get there, but he can score when asked to. He's not asked to shoot the ball very often, which I think at this stage is good for him. And I think it's good for guys to learn how to earn minutes through their defense and through their energy, and let that translate once they do get the offensive opportunities. If they, you know, eventually do get them, you know, guys like Jaylen Brown, and to a lesser degree, Jason Tatum are actually good examples of that on the Celtics. But long-term, if the shot comes around, I could see him being, I think, at least a second unit bench scorer. The guy I kind of compare him to in my mind is Caris LeVert. I think they have pretty similar games. LeVert obviously plays for the Nets. But, you know, even he at this stage of his career, not a particularly great offensive scorer, and a particularly efficient offensive option, I should say. And so it's another one of those things where, okay, he's got some skill on offense, but is he really good enough at everything else to justify, you know, being on the floor, because he's not efficient enough to be a primary option. So for Romeo, he's going to have to be, I think, a good enough spot-up shooter to space the floor, and a good enough and versatile enough defender to justify playing a key rotation role, because I'm not sure he's going to be that primary option at the NBA level. And so then, you know, if he's not that, you go down kind of down the list and say, okay, what else does he do? How else does he help us? And so for him, it's going to be figuring out ways beyond his isolation and pick and roll scoring to help the team win. It's going to be making the extra pass, which the Celtics are very good at teaching. So I think he's in a good environment for that. It's going to be attacking closeouts. It's going to be making the best of kind of limited opportunity, and then, you know, playing his ass off on defense and kind of, you know, earning his keep that way, which I think he can do. And then, you know, if Tatum leaves in free agency, if Brown gets traded, I'm not saying these things will happen, but, you know, if that team sees some kind of shakeup and they need someone to slide into more of a scoring role, maybe he's good enough by that point to help them there. But at least for the time being, I think in the next couple months, what we're going to see him do is, you know, be asked to play 10 minutes, play really hard off the bench, and just kind of spell guys like Tatum and Brown on the wing until they can come back in the game. And just, you know, if he plays 10 minutes a game and doesn't kill the Celtics, I think you're happy with that if you're a Celtics fan or an Indiana fan. And you know, even if you're Romeo Langford, I'm sure he wants more, but I think if you can play that role this season as a rookie, that's a pretty good place to start moving forward into the rest of your career.
And I want to wrap up here by touching briefly on the three guys that we haven't discussed that are in the NBA. And I'm going to kind of ask you, I don't know what the best way to word this is, so forgive me if I don't, if the wording's not the best here, but we've got obviously Yogi Ferrell in Sacramento, Juwan Morgan in Utah, and Noah Vonleh in Denver. And I view all these three right now as basically fringe NBA players. Do you agree with that assessment? And of those three guys, who do you think maybe has a chance to stick it out in the league the longest? I was a little bit surprised myself that Juwan even, not that I don't think he's good enough, but you know, he's on a, obviously a playoff contending team. The other two have kind of had a little bit longer of a track record and bounced around, but you know, do you agree with all those three at this point in their careers as fringe NBA guys? And of the three, who do you maybe see sticking it out the longest in the league?
I probably agree with that. I think it's easier just kind of by nature for solid backup point guards to stick around and make a living. So maybe the most likely to have a long career is Yogi, but the guy I'm most intrigued by is actually Vonleh. And he's been interesting to me for a while, you know, ever since he was in Portland. I think he's a good rebounder. I think he shows signs of being a decent defensive anchor. He's not nearly consistent enough to do that, and I don't think he's going to play much of a role at all for the Nuggets in the playoffs. But I think long-term, like we saw a little bit of it with the Knicks last season when he was, you know, empowered a little bit more on offense. He could do a little bit more. He's worked on the jumper a little bit. He's not nearly a reliable three-point shooter, but as far like I think he has a little bit of untapped offensive skill. He could be a quality role man going downhill toward the basket, a good finisher, you know, standing in the short corner and catching lobs. I think he's versatile on defense. I think he's got good enough foot speed that he can switch onto a lot of different guys. Like I mentioned, solid rebounder. And then if the defensive instincts ever come around, I think he could be an intriguing kind of backup combo big. I don't know that he's ever going to be a full-time starter on anything close to a good team, but he could help a quality team, you know, no question to me, if he can kind of put all those tools together. And then Juwan, I think, is unquestionably my favorite player of those three, just because I covered him in Indiana. I'm a big fan of his game, but he's one of those guys who, you know, has a great college career, but it's just hard to see that type of game translating to the NBA. Again, unless you're Karl Anthony Towns, it's just really hard to be a ball dominant post big man and have much of a role at all. So I think he's done a good job adapting and making the most of his minutes in Utah. He's played really hard when he's been in. He's you know, finding ways to affect the game, particularly on defense. When he gets in the game, he still needs to work on his foot speed. The few minutes of his that I've watched this season, he's gotten burned a little bit on switches with guys going by him, baited into some cheap fouls, which that'll get better with time. But the defense, the versatility on defense, I think, needs to sharpen up a little bit. But he's got good instincts. He plays hard. He's mostly in the right places. So he's another guy I think could just be kind of a, you know, quality backup power forward who plays 10, 12 minutes a game when you need him to in spot duty. And then if you don't need him in the rotation, it's not the end of the world, and you can kind of afford to not play him if you need to. But he's nice to have there, you know, if you do need him. So that's kind of the role I view him playing in Utah. I don't know if that'll come as soon as this year, but you know, next season, moving forward, I could see him in Utah or somewhere else being that kind of player.
Yeah, Ben, we'll get you out of here on this. Just to quickly touch on maybe the sports media aspect of this. Obviously, all of us are kind of used to covering games in the traditional sense, and you know, media availabilities, just the way that you present stories to readers and the audience out there. But we've seen in college basketball things like, you know, the coaches being mic'd up during games. I know your feelings are pretty strong against the players broadcast on TNT every time they do that for NBA games. But in this kind of post-COVID-19 world that we're going to live in, and especially maybe the way ESPN is going to have to package these NBA games without fans, without the traditional in-stadium, in-arena experience, maybe what are your thoughts on how things could change for the better and just how things might change in general in terms of how we're going to be watching NBA games come the end of July, should everything go smoothly?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think for the bubble, the most intriguing idea to me is just turn the court mics way up and just make that the game feed. You know, like, let me hear everything, you know, that LeBron is saying when he's the backside defender, you know, all the defensive communication that goes on, all the talk between the players, the trash talk, if you're interested in that as well. I think all the conversations and the communication that goes on an NBA court, it's so much more than we hear in like the very limited access we get, whether that's through, you know, errant court mics on, or I guess, turned up court mics on broadcast, whether it's players being mic'd up, whether it's behind the scenes footage. We only see and hear a fraction of those conversations. And I personally would be really interested to hear what it sounds like to listen to a team communicate through two teams really throughout an NBA game. I think that would be really, really fascinating. You do worry a little bit about the profanity and the language, but I mean, they put The Last Dance on ESPN, right? So, I mean, maybe you could put a disclaimer like, hey, listen, this is going to contain mature language. Be cautioned, and maybe you put the clean feed on ESPN2 or something. I don't know exactly how it would work, but for me, that would be by far the most appealing option. Like, we don't even need broadcasters, I don't think. Although I wouldn't say no to Ian Eagle calling most of these games, but I don't even know that we need commentators. I think we can just turn the court mics up, give me that feed, and I'll be satisfied with that.
Well, Ben, thanks for taking the time. We always appreciate catching up with you. Where can everybody stay up to date with what you're doing right now? What's the best way to connect with you?
You can go to si.com/NBA/Hawks. That's where all of my Hawks writing was this past season. On Twitter at @bladner_. I haven't been tweeting much these days and probably won't for the foreseeable future, but if people want to check that out, they still can. Other than that, honestly, I've been trying to go a little darker on the internet recently, so I think that's been good for me, even if it does leave me with very little to plug in these guest appearances.
Well, we always enjoy your insight. Thanks for coming back onto the show. We're proud of the work that you did. And like I said, you're one of the guys who have always respected your opinion on the game of basketball, just because you understand it so well and put it so well into words, and also with your writing. And Cam, thank you for joining me this week as the guest host for our second episode of Podcast on the Brink. We will be back next week with another episode. Until then, thanks everybody for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Podcast on the Brink. We always appreciate you being here. Remember to join me and my co-hosts for more IU basketball talk at assemblycall.com, and visit Alex over at insidethehall.com for complete coverage of Indiana basketball. If you want to support Podcast on the Brink, here is the single best way to do it. Tell anyone you know who loves IU hoops about us and suggest that they subscribe. Podcast on the Brink can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else podcasts are available. Tell your social media followers, email your friends, text your family members. For weekly discussion about IU basketball, they need to be subscribed to Podcast on the Brink. We'll talk to you next time. Go Hoosiers.